Now's the time to find your color, your paint, and everything to get started during Red, White, and Blue Savings at the Home Depot. Transforming your room is easier than ever. With the best deals online and in-store, you can confidently select your color and the tools for your next paint project. Get a colorful new experience and the right paint for the right price. Save $10 on 1 gallon and $40 off 3 and 5 gallons for a limited time only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Limit 25 gallons per household. See store for details.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rusland, today we have one of the founding fathers. He's on the Mount Rushmore of a bit of culture, Sharad Kutan.
Oh, always a pleasure to be here, Cam.
Great to have you. And we have the man I consider to be BFM's Mr. Tech. He knows how to program the VCR, Matt Armitage.
I had a Betamax. Morning, Cam. How are you?
You have to be contrarian, don't you? Anyway, so our three topics this week is topic number one, is art easy to satirize? Topic number two is the faceless, nameless music artist. And finally, topic number three is, what would you do if you were an exec in the age of Trump and Brexit? TV exec. So, Sharad.
Well, because we had news just last week of the winner of the Palme d'Or from Cannes, and it is Ruben Östlund's The Square, which is a satire of the art world. And I was thinking to myself, because I've seen movies like this, or the premise of which is the art world, artists, agents, patrons of the art, collectors, all these things, and there's the general public, media and such. These are the people that you find in the art world. Are they easier to satirize than, say, any other worlds, you know, where you say accountants or the sporting world or, you know, and such? And I was thinking that perhaps there are things, and you know, think of the particular vocabulary, there's some pomposity, verbosity, you know, one gets all very proper and very, very intellectual. And
no, I think you're satirizing it now.
Right. And in fact, there is this idea, especially with the advent of kind of cultural studies and high theory and art, even kind of ramping up of that verbosity and pomposity and self-importance, all of which lends itself for some sort of deflation, which I think is the point of a satire, right? Satire, in some ways, deflates the world, maybe subtly, maybe with in a way that becomes a point of reflection for larger society as well. So all that I'm putting on the table, but I don't know. I don't live in the world of tech geeks, for instance. And, you know, I imagine, Matt, that they would be easy to satirize because they're so earnest.
Well, there are. I mean, there are a lot of...
Silicon Valley.
Silicon Valley is a great satire. The IT crowd. It is very easy to take the mickey out of that kind of person. The Big Bang Theory, which has been going for forever. So there are a lot of satires that that work in this area, or usually within a kind of sitcom format. But yes, it does depend on the sort of métier, I think. I mean, I think it's harder to come up with a satire on accountants, for example, because what they do is very kind of run of the mill and quotidian. So you actually then have to create things around them for the satire to work. With artists, I think it's easier because they're dealing in a much more kind of conceptual field, and they tend to be kind of larger than life personalities.
So they're actually much more interesting to watch as a subject for a satire.
I think so, and I think it's actually easier to set them up for those jokes along the way. If you look at something like The Office, it had a very specific way that it worked through because the subject matter is very grey and the people are very grey. So you have to have a lot of set pieces, like, you know, the dancing and the comedy routines and the manager who thinks he's a cut above everyone else.
But that was a satire on office politics and also on self-inflated, pompous male ego.
Yes, of course.
Because I don't know what they actually did in the office.
But that's the point. That's the point. The job itself doesn't lend itself to the satire. So you're actually critiquing, as you said, the office politics. I think with the art world, again, because you have these larger than life personalities, you can do that on a sort of case by case basis. The personalities and the characters lend themselves to satire a lot easier.
So there's an art magazine called artnet.com, and it actually picked up on The Onion, which is because the American satirical website magazine, and its top art world parodies. And I can just read you a couple of them. So the National Endowment for the Arts, which is an American thing, and crafts, criticized for funding giant macrame penis. That's one. Mapplethorpe's Children's Museum celebrates grand opening. So you can already see, I can see the smiles on your face. You're not laughing out loud because that's the nature of satire. You sometimes, if it's dark enough, you don't laugh out loud.
Well, you have to know who Mapplethorpe was.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. No, for sure. To enjoy that, you really have to be
you're congratulating yourself on knowing that.
Okay, non-controversial Christ painting under fire from art community.
Okay.
So you know what this is a reference to, and that very controversial artwork that maybe I shouldn't say this on air.
But hang on. So satire, as I think I understand it, it's the below attacking the above. It doesn't go downwards because that's just bullying. If you can choose a bastion of elitism, and then you can attack that, so the art world would be one.
Oh, there's another one from The Onion. Magical art gallery transforms dull objects into art. And so it goes, Seth Clayton's devastating Untitled Number 7 captures the despair of urban ennui in a way that post-ironic yet somehow pre-promo, okay. Says blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
You can see the language. So the language of the art world is also ripe for satirization because of the, again, it's full of these like... it's self-referential, it's coded, it's convoluted and kind of unnecessarily convoluted.
But I think also there's that element that people don't always understand. So there's the current Amazon show, I Love Dick.
Which I have not seen, but it's supposed to be good.
Yeah, very good, worth watching. But again, one of the artworks that belongs to Dick is a brick on a pedestal, and that gets knocked off in one scene and it breaks into three pieces on the floor. So Dick wanders back into his gallery drunk and simply rearranges the pieces of the brick in a different shape, crosses out whatever year it was originally made and writes 2017 next to it. And there he's got a new artwork. So I think certain things are kind of ripe for this kind of satire. And when you see sort of normal sitcoms, you'll often see the trope of an artist doing something like Pollock or Rothko, you know, splashing some paint on the floor or just painting a canvas a single color. So,
But then they're portrayed as being charlatans.
Yes, that's the point. I think
so that taps into the you know, my 5-year-old could do that.
Yes, precisely. That's the kind of thing. It's a trope that comes out through a lot of
but things. And it's Trumpian as well, because I mean there they are. There are these elites who are laughing at us because we're so stupid that we don't understand the artwork that my 5-year-old could do. Therefore, let's attack them.
Okay, so this is the point in which I say I make a spirited defense for art and the art world, because I do think that, say, if you take a Jackson Pollock or a Rothko and all that, they are important. And what they did wasn't simply throwing paint on the floor, on a canvas, laid on the floor. Sorry.
Of course they're not. But people who don't understand that process just see somebody who splashed paint on a floor. That's why it becomes something that's very easy to repeat within these shows.
We should move on. But Sherrod, so therefore you basically, in a nutshell, you're against this kind of satire. It's mean.
No, I love this kind of satire because, you know, because I'm interested in art and because I know the in-jokes, I can come away from these things feeling clever. And that's the most important thing. Isn't that what entertainment is supposed to do? Give you pleasure?
And a sense of superiority. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. So I think we've just worked everything out. Okay, but we're going to move on now to topic number two with Mr. Betamax.
Yes.
The nameless, faceless artist.
Yeah, there's been a lot of debate recently about whether technology is good for artists, whether things like Spotify and Tidal and Apple Music, whether they work for the artist, whether being on these kind of streaming platforms and renting people their music is good for them rather than selling them. But there's also been a rise of artists who are bypassing the normal channels and are going straight for the streaming audience. So there's now a pool of artists who have really big hits on services like Spotify. They can get streams of 35, 40 million. There's a few with sort of well over 100 million who have no presence and no recording label. They've just come to preeminence through these streaming services. They've been put into, say, an official playlist by Spotify, which has given them access to a wider audience, then that has gone virally. And of course, those artists are receiving the money for those streams. But nobody really knows who they are. Nobody really knows where they've come from. And it just seems to be that we're getting to this stage now where we disassociate the artists, we disassociate the songs from the artists, and we don't have that kind of connection with the people who make music that we used to have, say, a decade ago.
But are you talking about a minority phenomenon here? I mean, because every day when I'm on air, we talk about musicians, and it's clearly they are fans, and you know, and musical tastes are shaped around very distinct identities of individuals or bands, you know, who are making this music.
Well, yeah, are these people with these multi-million hits, are they one-hit wonders, or are they
not necessarily? No, some of them have actually built careers, so they're becoming touring artists. So they do sort of connect to a populace offline. But what we're also finding is the flip side. A lot of the bigger artists, the ones who are promoted by record labels, they are known simply song by song. So we're not streaming albums. The younger generations don't stream albums. They just go for individual tracks, and they don't care what the artist looks like. So you get this situation where the song is incredibly popular, but nobody has the first idea who the artist is.
Can you give us an example?
I was actually searching for an article that I read before we came online, and I couldn't find it, so I can't remember the names of any of these things. But
sounds like my academic career, that
yes,
one. Yes,
pretty much. But what seems to be happening as well is that we have a rise in YouTube stars who are covering other people's songs. And because we don't know the faces and the personalities of the artists who do the originals, these YouTube stars become the personification of the stars because they're interacting with their fan bases. So they can have followings or subscriber bases numbering in the millions. Like I said, we're getting this generation now of YouTube stars who are actually doing cover versions. They're making a name for themselves doing cover versions.
This is a strange new world.
Of course, because their fan base knows the song, but they don't know the original artist. So they have this relationship with the YouTube stars because they can put comments or they can follow the Instagram. So they're getting their personification from these other people who are doing interpretations of the original.
I mean, haven't you watched those videos on YouTube of, I don't know, some often kids from the Philippines doing some cover version or something?
And they're so
animated and campy and delightful, and you know, and then they often like look like they're poor, and therefore you think, wow, they're poor and they're talented and they're extraordinary, you know, in their ability to mimic the original. And so it's not some sort of, you know, kind of deep, kind of culturally infused interpretation. It's like, wow, he sounds just like, you know, or he sounds just like Mariah Carey.
Well, I don't know about the Filipino ones that you're talking about, but yeah, I've enjoyed many of these people.
Yeah, but these guys are slightly different in that they are actually carving a career. Their career path is specifically to cover all of these different songs by other people and perform them to their fan base.
Is this not actually a purer form of cultural receivership? Because, you know, we are not overwhelmed by people selling a personality and clothes and lifestyle, but we're just having the music. Isn't that a good thing?
No, I think it is a good thing. I'm not actually against this. Right. I think it's an interesting change. I mean, we see the older generation of artists who bemoan the fact that nobody's buying their CDs anymore and they're not making money. And, oh my gosh, they actually have to go out and play their songs in front of an audience to actually make any money. Forgetting the fact that for thousands and thousands of years, the only way that musicians make money is by going out and playing in front of an audience. The idea of selling your music to someone is very recent. I mean, even as recently, I think, as the 1940s or 50s, artists did not make any money from selling their music.
Of course.
You know, the record company system was set up against it. And of course, selling recorded music is only something that we've been able to do for 100 years.
But also, back in those long ago days, selling sheet music was,
But again, that didn't go back to the artist. That went back to the publishing company.
Unless on the rare occasion that the artist actually wrote the piece of music as well.
So they were always famous and poor? Is that the situation?
Yes, yes.
Musicians, I mean, have always historically been poor.
Musicians, if you go back to the early days of the recording industry, the musicians were on a wage. They didn't get royalties from the performances of the songs. They were on a wage from the company, and they would sing whatever they were told to sing, hence the Tin Pan Alley, the songwriting industry.
So let's extrapolate forwards then. So therefore, the future is going to be what?
I think the future is going to be artists who, if they're lucky, they can make money from their songs by them being popular on these services. I think a lot of artists are going to be bypassing recording companies simply because there's no need for one. If you can go straight to a service like Spotify and take 100% of what you make instead of taking 3% of what you make or 5% of what you make, which is traditional with a record company, that's the way that people are going to go. Because once you do that, one hit can actually generate a lot more from you.
You have to have millions of hits to make any money at all on Spotify.
You do if you're any artist.
Okay.
So that doesn't really make a difference.
But for Taylor Swift, it's a side income, Spotify.
No, increasingly not. Touring is the main income, but physical sales are, for a lot of artists, physical sales now fall below streaming income. So they make more money from the combination of Tidal and Spotify.
Cam, you're clearly in the wrong business. You should be writing novels. Get onto Spotify. Into your inner...
I've only read things about Spotify saying that it's just impossible to make any money out of it as an artist, unless you have millions of hits.
Of course, and you have to have millions of hits. So if you look at an artist like Kendrick Lamar, I think somebody crunched the numbers on his previous album release, and he made something like $3 million in a weekend on the release of his album.
Yeah, you're right.
If you look at services like Spotify, they actually give out 75% of their income back to the record labels. Oh. So if artists are complaining that they're not making enough money, that's not because the money is not coming from Spotify.
It's because they're whingers.
No. It's because the money is not coming from their label. So they have to look at whether they need these labels as a middleman. Right. Because you've got a middleman who's taking probably 90% of your cut, which is not a middle. It's a most.
So, okay, in a nutshell then, will there be any future Taylor Swifts and Beyoncés?
Yes, there will be, but they won't necessarily be the people who made the song originally popular. And again, it's going back to an earlier time, say the music hall artists, for example, who would sing popular songs and they could become famous for their version of that song. Mm. So I think we're going to see people becoming a lot more famous for cover versions in the future rather than just for putting out original material.
Okay. God, that's a strange world we live in.
It's a whole new life for Bowie.
Okay, and on that happy note, we take a break, and in a moment we're going to talk about what we would do if we were TV execs here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9.
Now's the time to find your color, your paint, and everything to get started during Red, White, and Blue Savings at the Home Depot. Transforming your room is easier than ever. With the best deals online and in-store, you can confidently select your color and the tools for your next paint project. Get a colorful new experience and the right paint for the right price. Save $10 on 1 gallon and $40 off 3 and 5 gallons for a limited time only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Limit 25 gallons per household. See store for details.
And we're back with myself, Cam Raslan, Sharad Kutan, and Matt Armitage. Now, topic number three, what would we do if we were TV execs? I'm going to put the question to you in a moment. First of all, so in the age of Trump and Brexit, we have at the moment a situation in America land where have been a number of political dramas on TV, but they're not really succeeding. Scandal, if anyone remembers Scandal, is losing audiences. House of Cards has just come out with a new season, but it's not really generating the same buzz that it once had. Because how can these fictional political scandal shows compete with the reality of the craziness of the Trump regime? Whatever storyline they come up with, it just cannot match. And in Britain, I watch, and Matt, you also, we watch a lot of British TV cop shows.
Yeah, of course.
And all of these shows that we're talking about were written, shot before Brexit vote was taken and before the last election in America. So traditionally, I've found, anyway, with these British cop shows, almost every single one has a storyline involving immigrants, right? Always immigrants. And they're always portrayed sympathetically. And if you see a brown or black face in one of these things, you know he or she did not commit the crime. They never do. But the Brexit vote has shown us, I think, that actually the actual British TV audience is very unsympathetic towards immigrants and would probably enjoy having a TV show where these immigrants come and they slaughter good British people in their beds at night. But the TV stations have not been pandering to that audience. So as a strange example, recently, you know, Tim Allen, the American...
Tooltime.
That's right, Tim Tooltime Allen. He has a TV show, or had rather, called Last Man Standing, and it got cancelled. Now, the ostensible reason, the official reason, is because of a scheduling format change. But the feeling is that his show was cancelled because he is famously out of step with sort of Hollywood community. He's a very conservative person. And his character is almost sort of Trumpian and, you know, harks back to the days when men were men and women were women and all that kind of thing. And they cancelled his show. So I'm wondering, if we were TV execs, there clearly is an audience that's open to dramas where foreigners are demonized and all Muslims are bad and all that kind of thing.
Well, Life on Mars, I mean...
But that's going way back.
It does go way back, yeah. But what it does is allows you to have the politically incorrect, homophobic, misogynistic, racist, bullying, indifferent to political niceties type of characters.
Just clarify, that's a TV show from the early 2000s that was set in the 1980s.
Yeah, so somebody 70s. Travels...
And 70s. 70, yeah.
Travels back in time. We don't really know if he's traveling back in time, but the point is he's in a different world where it's possible. So, you know, I'm watching this thing, or been watching it called Versailles. And, you know, when I look at these historical dramas, what I want to experience is a different cultural and social logic. I don't want them to be politically correct. I don't want my women heroes, you know, doing somersaults and, you know, I want them to kind of be the stereotype of another world, because I think that would be interesting, right? I love the brutality. I love the blood and gore and the lack of finesse and, you know, the lack of political correctness, because that would be interesting. Otherwise, it's just sort of like today, but, you know, in costumes, and who would want that?
So hang on. So your choice would be then to go back to do dramas that are back in time.
Well, I think that's already been done. If I was a TV exec, I would be driving a very swish car and have really nice suits. I'd have really well-tailored suits. But and I would also want to do something that was dark and, you know, reflective of the present. So I would push for something that would just get everybody screaming. That's the kind of TV exec. And I'm available for hire, by the way.
All right. Matt?
Well, I think there are shows like 24,
yes,
for example.
The execrable 24.
Exactly, where every Muslim is portrayed as being a potential terrorist.
Unless you beat them. If you beat them, then they'll spill out information
about
where the bomb's going to be.
Yes, very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's also a counter to this as well. I think there was news earlier this week that a show called Underground, which shows on an American network called WGN, and it's about the Underground Railroad, the slaves escaping.
From the 1830s.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. One of the producers of the show is the musician, John Legend. So I think they've had two or three seasons so far, and that has just been cancelled. Mm. But coincidentally, the network has just been taken over, and it's thought that they're going to be pushing in a more conservative direction.
Oh.
So a show about slavery and people escaping the chains of bondage, et cetera, is not thought to be in line with what they're going to do in the future. So I think it's cutting both ways. I don't think Last Man Standing was cut because of Tim Allen's political leaning. I have watched the show.
Mm.
So there's another reason that it would be cut, that it's just not terribly good, and it is
it was getting good ratings, though.
I think it was getting okay ratings, but I'd have to look at the figures, but I think it was on the slide. But if you look at a lot of sitcoms across the major US networks, they are very, very traditional. They are very, very white. They're about the nuclear family. So I don't think there's any lack of this kind of conservative viewpoint in a lot of TV shows in the US. I don't think it is this kind of bastion of liberalism that that we perceive, because a lot of the time it's the cable shows we're talking about, the stuff on HBO, the stuff on WGN, which does tend to be more liberal because it's going for a niche audience.
You know, I do think, and I'm tugging at the sleeves of my Armani suit here, that if I did this show, it would draw in conservative audiences thinking it's a celebration of conservative values, but then I would flip it. I would undermine it, and there would be a cathartic and transformative moment, a moment of deep redemption that would take the conservative mind through a journey of self-discovery.
So what you're saying is realization.
It'd be TV epiphany.
Yeah. So what you're saying is you would make mind your language, but it would be mind your language.
Absolutely.
Sharad, you think you're doing a good pitch, but that's a terrible pitch. Because,
is it?
Yeah, because you're not actually telling people what it's about.
Oh.
That's all they want to know. It's like if it's mind your language meets 24, then, you know, the audience understand it.
Obviously, Sharad is an action hero. He's going to be portrayed, you know, with the fan blowing, the flowing locks. You know, it's going to be the full works.
Hang on. So therefore, all right, let's look at...
Paul Dark. Let's do Paul Dark.
Let's look at post-Brexit Britain, speaking of Paul Dark. So we have a situation where the Brexit plebiscite showed that the British audience, well, the English audience rather, are xenophobic and insular,
yes.
Right? Okay, I think we can draw that conclusion.
Yes.
So the TV shows that they've been receiving, trying to promote a sense of openness and inclusion and offices where every type of color of skin is in there, should they not now jettison that and go straight out, foreigners are bad?
I mean, you say that, but I have to be kind of careful about what I say here. My sister-in-law is actually a TV producer in London.
Hand her my card. Thank you.
Yeah. And she has worked on a lot of shows that would be showing more of a minority perspective.
Mm.
And it's very, very hard, even before Brexit, to get those shows picked up. She still comes up against essentially a white wall. So if there are too many characters who are of a particular ethnicity, or if the language is too street, or it's perceived as not being accessible to a wider white audience, then the shows don't get picked
okay.
up.
All right. Yeah. I'm mistaken. So it's been like that for a while, and it's just going to get worse.
Whether or not it will get worse, I mean, again, we have different places that content can come out now. So we're not dependent on the networks in the way that we were before. Look at a show like Dear White People on Netflix. Netflix has built itself around niche audiences.
I've watched that.
Yeah. I haven't seen the show yet, but Netflix is not a one-fits-all TV network. It doesn't have to do things for the mass appeal like an ITV or a BBC One. So it can afford to go into these areas that the other TV networks won't touch and make programming for ethnic minorities, different religious groups, all of these kind of things, because there is sufficient an audience for them to be profitable.
Well, sexual orientation is very interesting.
That one as well. Yes,
I mean,
of course,
India's
sorry.
Had show movies. Indian movie makers are now doing a taboo subject and debuting on Netflix and not, you know, India. So it's very interesting because you're really providing a real avenue for all kinds of alternatives. I mean, I'm talking about Netflix here.
Okay. So Matt, your conclusion is that the networks and all the various independent networks are becoming balkanized, atomized, and will go for niche. Whereas Sharad over there, he would still like to create that one piece that would challenge the conservative audience and excite
without them
the
even
liberals
knowing
at the same
it.
Time.
Without they would just be loving it. They'd be lapping it up. They'd be like eating ice cream and strawberries and, you know,
okay.
And then they'd be like so excited. And then suddenly there's this moment of deep misrecognition.
Right. Okay, and the actual storyline is to be determined.
No, yes. I can't remember the name of the show. This is towards the end of the Cold War where the Russians had their own answer to James Bond.
Oh,
yes. And James Bond actually starred in one of those films, but he was killed in the first 6 minutes because the Russian agent was the hero. So, you know, you always have the two sides to the same story.
And also because I should imagine there are going to be lots of Russians in the TV exec kind of being put in there to determine what's going on in America anyway. Okay, so my side, I don't know. Actually, I don't know. I mean, if the audience is there and they're and they want blood and they want that conservative message, you kind of think, well, you just got to give it to them.
Yeah, Paul Dark meets Caligula. That's what I'd do.
Okay.
And okay. that's for lunchtime viewing.
Yes, obviously. Yes.
All right, okay. Well, we look forward to that one, Sharad. And so now we come to the final part of the show, recommendations. We recommend something that we think might be of interest. And Sharad goes first.
Well, you know, funny that you mention Dear White People, because I did watch the whole first season. But that's not what I'm going to recommend, because I didn't think it was as interesting as the premise suggested it could be. It didn't go too far enough in terms of the complexity of the characters. But chewing gum, I don't know if you've seen this. This is an old 2014 British television sitcom set in London, written by Michelle Coyle and some other a bunch of people. Centered around the protagonist is a black British woman in a kind of working class district. They're so funny, but they deal with race and religion and, you know, council flats and government and drugs. All of it brilliantly. I mean, it's just, I think it's exquisite.
Sorry,
have you seen it?
Sorry, yes, I have. Season 2 is on Netflix now, and that is actually one of my sister-in-law's shows.
Oh, congratulations to her, because I love chewing gum, because I just thought it was so funny.
It's so uncomfortable to watch as well. I mean, it's, you know, you really are wincing. Yeah, it's adapted from a one-woman stage play. Okay. Actually, by the lead actress.
Well, Michelle Cole.
I have never heard of this show, Chewing Gum. I will
TV
check it
series.
Out. I've been looking for something funny. I desperately want to watch
something
funny.
Like I said, season 2 has just hit Netflix as well.
So season 2, that's like 5 whole episodes.
Season 1 is, yes, it's a British show, so 6 episodes. Season 1, I think, is better than season 2.
Okay.
But
don't let your sister know that. Okay, so that's Chewing Gum. All right, check that out. And Matt, what's yours?
Well, mine's going to be a bit flat compared to that, unfortunately. I would like to recommend a series of books, The Chronicles of St. Mary, for fans of Terry Pratchett, now that he's sadly gone. But it's the normal kind of silly fantasy stuff, but it's based around a team of time-traveling historians. And the historians are actually action heroes, so they're able to jump backwards and forwards to all the big events in time and chronicle some of them. So they go back and they fight with dinosaurs and they see what happens at the signing of the Magna Carta and all of this kind of stuff. And of course there's all kinds of intrigue because it's a timeline based scenario, so they even have versions of their own organization jumping back in time and interfering with what they do, and various supervillains that they meet at different points in their life. So they'll defeat a supervillain and kill him before he's even met them for the first time. There's all these kind of weird little complications. It's very nicely done. It's very, very funny. So, yeah, check out the Chronicles of St. Mary stories by Jodie Taylor.
Now, my recommendation was kind of spurred on by Matt's last recommendation when he was here last, which was he was very excited and effusive about a TV show, a British TV show, called Line of Duty. And it was one of the most emphatic endorsements ever on a bit of culture. So I finally watched it and I was like, it was okay. But then Matt told me just now, earlier, that I had to get past episode 2 of season 1 before it really became something happening.
It's not that it becomes something happening, it becomes something completely different.
All right,
so
okay.
You think you're watching one kind of show for the first couple of episodes, and you get to the end of episode 2 and you think, well, I know exactly what's going to happen in the next 4 episodes. I know who the villain is. I know who's done, you know, as a whodunit, this doesn't work because I know everything.
Exactly. That was exactly what I was thinking.
But then a second later, everything explodes in your face and it's suddenly a completely different show.
Have you seen, by the way, just, I mean, to add to that, The Night Of?
Oh, yes.
It is.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
With Riz
well.
Ahmed. Oh, yes. My God. Brilliant, brilliant. Mm-hmm. And again, one of those things where you think you know where it's going to go, and it goes to some really dark places. Oh, boy.
And that was an American adaptation of a British one, again, called Criminal Justice. So anyway, Line of Duty was the thing. But when I finally gave up on that, I looked on the... And people who like this also like this, I saw, and it's a thing called River, a TV show called...
Oh, that's really good. It's really funny.
It's funny? You have an interesting sense of humor. It is. It does have, but it's not like a comedy, though. River is another BBC detective show. This is a one-off series of 6 one-hour episodes, and it stars Stellan Skarsgård, Swedish actor. So in this, he is a TV detective.
Oh, I know. He's great. I love him.
TV detective. And you run with that, and he sees dead people. The character sees dead people, but not in a sixth sense kind of way. I mean, they are obviously manifestations of his psyche.
Yeah, that's why I say it's funny, because it's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous premise, but it's an entirely believable and workable show.
Yeah. It's very psychologically and emotionally centered. Great performance by him. And it's wonderful. I watched it almost in one sitting. It's just really great. River.
I think they are planning another season, hope.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. So just to conclude, my recommendation is River. It's really great. Please watch it. I love it. So anyway, so that brings us to the end of this week's show. Only remains for me now to thank special honored guest Matt Armitage.
Thank you for letting me be here.
Pleasure to have you here. Sharad Kutan, who's not producer Ali, who is not allowed to bring a computer in next time.
Always a pleasure, Cam. Always a pleasure to be here.
Looking forward to your, or am I? Looking forward to your pulled up.
Looking out from Mount Rushmore, yes, down to the set.
Right. If you haven't seen Caligula
or Paul Duck,
the mind boggles, quite frankly. Anyway, so that brings us to the end of the week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, please do so. Sharad is across Twitter land.
At Sharad Kutan.
Matt is...
I'm across Instagram land at Culture Pop.
I'm pretty much here and there, not really. So, but please like our Facebook page. For every person who likes, they will get a free ticket to the premiere of Paul Dark Meets Caligula. And please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Now's the time to find your color, your paint, and everything to get started during Red, White, and Blue Savings at the Home Depot. Transforming your room is easier than ever. With the best deals online and in-store, you can confidently select your color and the tools for your next paint project. Get a colorful new experience and the right paint for the right price. Save $10 on 1 gallon and $40 off 3 and 5 gallons for a limited time only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Limit 25 gallons per household. See store for details.